Welcome back to the Mom Mentality Show. My name is Austin Chadwick and co-host is Chris Lucian. And today we are excited to have Carolyn Rose on the show. And we'll be talking about online mob programming, especially for learning, for example, in a university setting. Before jumping into those topics, can you please introduce yourself?
Sure. So I'm Carolyn Rose. I'm a professor in the School of Computer Science at Carnegie Mellon University. And my appointments are in the Language Technologies Institute and the Human-Computer Interaction Institute. So for the past few years, I've been doing work in the mob programming space, adapting it for group learning, especially in heavy software courses. And I'm happy to have this conversation to let you guys know more and hear more about what you have to say about it.
All right, awesome. Well, I guess jump right in and maybe tell the story of how you and your students started to experiment with mobbing.
Sure. I first heard about it from my colleague, Michael Hilton. He is a teaching professor in the School of Computer Science. And in his dissertation research, I believe that he was doing some work with mob programming. And so when he came in as faculty at Carnegie Mellon, he was really interested in how it might apply in our teaching. And so I had been working with another colleague, Maj Saker, in cloud computing, and he has a large online course. We were working together to investigate how to support students learning together in these project courses, and it seemed like the perfect opportunity. There were lots of things about mob programming we really liked. There was this idea that the roles, and especially the rotation of the roles, allowed people to see the problems from multiple perspectives, and that it was never on only one person to drive the problem solving forward. So it created a sense of intersubjectivity that's often the goal of paradigms for collaborative learning. And so it seemed like a fertile ground for a three-way collaboration between faculty to see how we could adapt it for our use, starting with this cloud computing course, but now it's expanding out to other courses as well.
Right on. And so the cloud computing course is the one where it started. So how exactly is mobbing done in that course? Is there a particular session where it happens? How is it facilitated? That kind of thing.
So the course is divided into units, each unit having a topic for some major area of cloud computing. And the students come into the unit, they read a primer to learn the new content. The mob session happens after they've been introduced to the new content so that they work together to get to know it in more of a tangible sort of way, solving a problem that can be solved in one session. So a session would be like no more than an hour and 20 minutes. And after they do that, then they move into a large scale project engagement where they're working individually. So they're continuing to learn, they're experimenting with the concepts, they're building on what they came to understand together during the mob session. And so that's repeated per unit through the course.
Okay, awesome. Yeah, and that's similar to actually what I've heard some people do in the industry. As you have heard me and Chris, we work at a place where we mob all the time, but there are teams that will kick off a feature or kick off some work by starting off with mobbing, and then they'll go off and go solo. That's great. I guess one specific question I had was in regards to the facilitation of the mob. How does that occur?
Yeah, so our mobs are all online, and we're building on past work that my research group has been doing since 2005, really, using intelligent conversational agents as facilitators for online learning groups. So since we had been working on this paradigm for quite some time, when we started to do the work for the online mob programming in a learning context, it seemed natural that the facilitator would again be a computer dialogue agent. Because in the course where we're doing this, we have sometimes 200 students, always kind of between 100 and 200. And so they work in small groups, but there's so many groups that it wouldn't be possible for an instructor to be the facilitator. We could think about having students be the facilitators, but what we have a role in our MOB paradigm that we call the project manager, which is like a facilitator in the MOB programming role sense, but the agent that is kind of orchestrating the whole thing is really watching over all the roles to make sure even that role is getting taken up by a student and carried forward the way that it should. So we see that even if we've got the roles and they're rotating, and even though we train the students in all of the roles before we use it in the substance of the course, we still feel like some support and scaffolding is a good idea. And so that scaffolding is offered through the intelligent conversational agents.
The word is what is that? How does that, I guess, manifest with the students? Are they having a conversation and then they see like a text chat pop up and kind of saying, hey, have you looked at writing a unit test or something? Or what's the, I guess, what's the physical interaction between the student and the machine and the other students?
So since we're doing, it's an online course.
Yeah.
And so the students are working in an online collaborative software development environment. So they might be working in something like AWS Cloud9, more recently we're moving into VS Code Live Share. So in that environment, all of the students are interacting through text chat anyway, and they have, you know, all their shared editors and the shared, you know, space where they are compiling the code and running the test cases. And so the agent communicates with them through the chat.
Oh, and that's interesting.
Yeah, but there's like a little chat comes up that says mob bot, and that's the bot that's doing the facilitation. And so that bot tells them when it's time to rotate. It tells them who's taking what role. It prompts them to listen to each other, to build on each other's ideas, sometimes introducing where they can find resources that they need for the activity that they're doing. And so we tend to divide the time into goals, like sub goals for the whole project, so that they would be working together on some code and it would end with a test case. And when they could move on to the next activity when they have satisfied that test.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So are the students communicating with each other verbally, but they're seeing this chatbot, or are they all navigating in by communicating via chat in order for somebody else to drive? Is that how it works?
They're all communicating through chat, and which is not how we thought would be best in the beginning when we first started to do this. But we experimented with lots of different ways that the groups could work together. And even though a lot of people are committed to the idea that it's much more natural to have them interact through audio or even like video, like we're doing over Zoom, it doesn't turn out to be the case. And it seems perfectly natural and seems to work much more smoothly to have them just interact through the chat.
That's fascinating. I think I had an indication of this maybe a year ago when I was part of a mob, but my audio was turned off because I was kind of involved in something else at the time that I had to be there. But I had overheard something because they were all communicating verbally, and I started typing in the chat. And for a while, I was navigating in the chat, and it actually it felt fine. I think that the point was communicated, and somebody else then read the chat and then navigated it verbally. But that's a really interesting notion. I think this is the first time that I've heard of people mobbing and entirely doing everything chat based with no audio. So that's an interesting concept.
Yeah, I think there's so many things about this that are so incredibly unique. The peer chat is one. And then you keep calling it intelligent conversation agent. Did I get that right?
Yeah.
Okay. Is this some kind of like AI that's like, is it monitoring the chat? And then it picks a question to ask, or how? If it's not too proprietary to get into the algorithm a little bit, but like how does it work exactly?
Actually not proprietary at all. It's all open source, and we're happy to share it with anybody. And we have lots of publications on our work. And I'm happy to talk to anybody offline who wants to play around with this idea. But these dialogue agents, they actually have a pretty simple control structure of, you know, I'm sure you know what a pushdown automaton is. And so the basic dialogue structure is, you know, behind the scenes, just a pushdown automaton. But there are sort of schemas that define interactions that these agents can have with people. And so, you know, you might have a set of, you know, plan operators that define these schemas, and then there are points where they're talking, points where they're listening. The way that we use them as facilitators is that, so using that kind of a schema, we have actually a wide range of conversational agents that can interact in a back and forth fashion, kind of like Amazon Alexa, within a small period of time. But they're, these little agents are being coordinated by a sort of broader mechanism that is listening in on every contribution to the chat from everybody, because it's all going through the same back end loop server that all of the individual client machines that the people in the group are attached to. So it can be processing every message that comes in. A lot of what we monitor is from the chat, but there's no reason why it couldn't also be monitoring other things that are being looped through that backend loop. So since everybody's display has to be updated, really, you know, there are lots of kinds of messages that get passed through that backend loop. And in some of our other studies that we've done over the years, we have paid attention to other streams of behavior. And more recently, we've been doing work in the multimodal space in what we're calling the smart office space, where actually a lot of listening happens through audio, through face detection, through active speaker recognition, through position detection, so that the agent is able to be monitoring and supporting behavior within a physical space as well. But in our mod programming stuff that we've mostly done, it's mostly been in these very text-based interaction spaces, where most of what we pay attention to in terms of what the agent is doing is coming from the chat. But we also look at which test cases have passed. And so we also look at, you know, what time is it in the activity? So maybe we it's time to move on to a phase, and we might be sort of watching for those time management kinds of things. And so there are all these, what we call listeners, that are watching what's coming through that that backend loop that's, you know, coordinating among the different clients attached to the same collaborative space. And so then whenever those listeners trigger that, you know, something has happened that should be supported or indicates some state about how the collaboration is taking place, then there's what we call an output coordinator that's keeping track of the state and deciding at any given time, you know, is some intervention needed. And then it might kick off one of those little agents that is, you know, essentially in its control structure, like I said, just a pushed on automaton thing, you know, can have some back and forth through natural. So how it works.
Yeah. So kind of to summarize, like, is that, so, you know, person one, person two, and person three are all interacting. Person three is contributing a lot, you know, maybe typing in a lot of stuff, and then person two might be driving. Person three is maybe not contributing as much, and so the agent notices that there's a disparity in contribution and says, "Hey, why doesn't person three chime in a little bit?" Yeah. Or something, right? Okay.
Yeah, that's one of the kinds of things that we might be monitoring for. We also monitor for things like people are not treating each other well, or gave an idea and it fell to the ground. Nobody responded to it. Nobody built on it. You know, it wasn't really elaborated. And so maybe you want to draw that idea out.
Interesting. So like automated sponsorship of saying, oh, that person had an idea, maybe we should try that out now or something like that. Interesting.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Yeah, it's this is fascinating for me. AI is kind of more Chris's area than me, so some of the words are above my head, but it's still very fascinating. Automated sponsorship—that's incredible. And if you don't mind me playing the devil's advocate a little bit with two AI people, is so if there's inequality of contribution, is it, if the other person just starts typing in random phrases, does it all of a sudden be like, oh, okay, I guess everyone's contributing now? Or is it a little bit smarter than that? Or like if it just said the word hi, for example, it's like, oh, person three has spoken now.
So I think what we tried to do is avoid putting the group in the situation where they would feel a reason to try to game it to that
extent. Okay.
And so first of all, we don't sort of jump in, and we're not being very controlling. So we don't jump in very often. We train the students how to do a mob, and we offer very light scaffolding unless something really goes wrong. And so as long as the students are kind of coming in knowing, you know, we're supposed to do this thing, the reason why we're doing it is because it's preparing us for this assignment that we have. So we really need to get something out of it, and we're supposed to, you know, turn in test cases or whatever. They're taking it more or less seriously, and we don't run into the situation very frequently that they try to game this aspect of it. A student is not participating as much as other students, and we're going to try to draw them out. We tried to do it in not a punishing way, but in a positive kind of a way. And it's possible that the group sort of doesn't take up the suggestion to try to jump in, but we're not going to keep harping on that issue anyway. And so a lot of the problems that you could imagine might happen, and that people would try to, you know, abuse the agents, it doesn't happen a lot in this context. I think it happened more in the earlier years of using these kinds of agents to support collaborative groups, but we've learned how to position them in ways that you know, are perceived as helpful and supportive in the environment, and not to control, but to just be a catalyst. And because of that, there just isn't the motivation to abuse them.
That's fascinating. That's phenomenal. That's
really cool. If there's any malintent, then it's just more ignored than manipulated, probably.
Yeah, I think the worst thing that we see is that sometimes the students come in and they have their own idea. So with the mod programming in particular, I think that there's a time pressure aspect that the groups come in. We as instructors, you know, to us, the most important thing that comes out of this whole activity that the students are doing together is that they learn the stuff that they need for the individual work that they're going to do after the mob. So I think that's really what sets it apart from doing mobs in industry, where what you really, really care about is the quality of the software that's produced. Yeah. We want them to have an experience that changes how they are as software developers going forward. And so because of that, we don't want them to get too caught up in the idea that they absolutely have to get every detail working perfectly by the end, because then in a way, it pushes them to subvert what we want, you know, the idea that they should be gaining something in their perspective from having shifted roles, from having seen each other being part of this activity from different angles. And so it used to be that it was hard to get them to stop and reflect as part of their process. And we've had to learn how to take some time pressure off of them so that they have space for that. And then the collaboration works out better. But we have to carefully set up the phases and the rotation timings and, you know, the chunking up of the instructions that we give them along the way to make sure that we're not making them feel so pressured that they start to, that the process breaks down and they just go for like whatever's going to get this software done as fast as possible, which, you know, sometimes means not even following the roles. You know, it might just be, you know, whoever knows how to do this best is just going to get in there and just do it, whether they're the driver or not. And not what we want.
But the other two people will end up watching that and hopefully learning something from it so that they can take that away and use on the assignment later.
Unless they disengage, you know. Yeah. So, I mean, if things break down very badly, then it doesn't work out so well, you know. Yeah. Ideally, mob programming should keep everybody engaged. When it's working well, that's what happens. Yeah. Sometimes we see that the driver and the navigator are very engaged with one another, but the other roles are less engaged. Yeah. Had to work really hard over the iterations to learn how to structure those roles so everybody feels like they have something that they're really contributing, that they need to be involved in, so that they don't kind of tune out.
Yeah. And thanks for fueling my skeptical questions. And but I guess is going out of hypothetical to how has it actually turned out in your coursework and your students with this kind of model? Yeah, what's kind of the before and after effects of doing it this way?
Well, the students are definitely gaining a lot over the you know, we've done a lot of iteration on this. And I think a lot of what we had to do is figure out what were the kinds of tasks that they benefited most from doing this together in this mode. And so we have had to redesign our activities many times. I think it's made us question as instructors, what is it that students really learn from doing for development? There's kind of a real prejudice in computer science that the best learning happens when people are actually churning code out, and that isn't always the case. But what we have found is that we can identify just those aspects of what students are going to work on to prepare, where it's complicated enough that it lends itself to multiple perspectives so that they can consider together the decision-making, that there's a real decision-making that needs to take place. It's not obvious what the driver should be doing. And that there are ideas that the mob can bring in, you know? And so there has to be some need to go back into the basic materials and bring ideas in and say, X, did you consider Y? And it, you know, which makes it more necessary to have all of the people talking. And so initially we picked out kind of inappropriate, I think, at least for our purposes, activities for them to do in this collaborative mode. And we learned over time what were the best opportunities per unit to bring this collaborative aspect in.
Do you, you mentioned earlier retrospectives and reflections. Do you have retrospectives built into the process at all, or reflecting, I guess, does the bot prompt that? Okay. So what does it say?
Yeah. So the bot is introducing the phases of solving. So part of that is about, like I said, there are these subparts of the project, but then within each subpart now, we have a programming part and a reflection part. Mm. And the reflection part, which might be before or after the programming, we either ask them to come up with alternative possible solutions and consider trade-offs, or we present them with multiple possible solutions and have them talk about the trade-offs. And so we've looked at, you know, the ordering, which ordering seems to be the optimal ordering. Also, what is the best sort of time split between actual programming and the reflection? And so what we're finding is we've been fine tuning it using an AI paradigm called reinforcement learning that allows us to do adjustments based on observing success or not and how the interactions are playing out. We've seen that the optimal settings vary depending upon the unit, and we're still trying to understand what about the actual programming task is it that determines whether you should reflect first and then program versus the opposite, and where the trade-off should be, because the results haven't always been consistent across all of our tests. But we are seeing that there is a lot to be gained by stopping the group and just having them reflect on solutions instead of always pushing forward on the actual production of the software.
Yeah, I think we see that in our environment as well. You know, there are some teams in the seven mobs that we have that are either reflecting every 45 minutes, and some that may do it weekly, or more often there's either a daily sort of look back on the work for the day, what can we change going forward. So I find that really interesting that it moves, it has different effects based on the before and the after. And so it's kind of an interesting thing to propose, I think, to the industry side is essentially doing a retrospective before the task. I think that's talked about a little bit, but maybe less often executed in practice. So
yeah, I think that the role that it can play in having them consider beforehand is to try to get them to explore the space of possible solutions so they don't commit too soon. And in particular, when it comes to learning from collaboration, it subverts the whole benefit of the group if they converge to an idea too soon. You want them to stop and consider, you want them to need to listen to each other, you want them to see value in somebody challenging their idea. If they come in and they're very predetermined, you know, like the solution seems very clear to them ahead of time, even if there are multiple solutions, but they come in with kind of having already decided what they think is the right thing, then it might be less valuable at that point to get them to stop and reflect because they just really want to jump in and they're not going to take the time to really genuinely reflect. Maybe if they try something and it doesn't work out so well, then maybe then they'll be more open. So the question might be, where in the process is the openness going to come? And that depends on the people and the task and sort of, you know, ideas that they brought in with them or not, you know, how they were kind of primed to think about this particular endeavor.
That reminds me, actually. So we've had similar things happen where if somebody's like really set on an idea or maybe they're just always contributing the idea and others are just willing to take a back seat to it. And so one thing that we started doing that might be interesting, and maybe you are already doing this, is a double blind idea generation. So this idea that everybody draws. So it's like everybody make a drawing of what you think the architecture will be. And then we keep them from each other. And then we show them all at the same time to everyone. And then we discuss afterwards. And then we also, in our retrospectives, we will, sometimes we will create all of our responses to the retrospective without showing it to anyone and then throw everything up onto the board at the same time. And I find that it's really beneficial because, especially in the everybody draws scenario, what we get is, you know, real technical engagement from everyone at the same time. So it's kind of an interesting thing.
Yeah, we have some past studies before we even started to do the mock programming where we used a paradigm like that, because there's a well-known finding that people can be inhibited even in their idea generation just from having, you know, started to hear somebody else who sounds like they know what they're talking about start to talk about an idea, you know, they just feel shut down by that. So that can be very effective. And but we definitely have the students in our class reading a primer and thinking about the activity a little bit before they come in. We haven't had them actually sit down and start to generate a solution before they come in, but they have a foundation to draw from. And we have seen that is very productive. One thing is that when you phase it between individual work and group work so that people are bringing in the group work, even though I would say, you know, I definitely affirm the idea that this is a good practice, sometimes you lose a lot of momentum by, you know, breaking off the individual work and shifting into that collaborative mode because now they have to catch each other up. And so it's important to make sure that the method of doing the catch up is used in a way that's productive while it's happening so that it isn't just lost time.
So I'm noticing here in the paper, and I think you've been talking about here and there, that there are ways to consensus building versus kind of idea generating. Are those things that the conversation agent, you know, stimulates in the conversation? So it'll ask for different solutions and then does it ask them to like, how does it help them decide, I guess, exactly? Yeah.
Yeah. The term consensus building can sound like the goal is for them to come to, you know, all agree on something. Uh-huh. But actually in the collaborative learning literature, it usually refers to group knowledge building, trying to develop a shared understanding of a complex phenomenon. And so the idea of consensus building is to get everyone's mental model out on the table and to make comparisons between them so that people understand why other people see things differently than them. And that shared understanding, even if it doesn't mean agreement, we see as more valuable in the end for the learning because you understand how multifaceted the problem space is. Mm. terms of changing them as software engineers and not just producing high quality code, you know, I think it can be justifiable. But I think that, you know, the values would change if what you really were interested in was the artifact.
Yeah, and I was having a conversation with an engineer, and we've had several conversations on the show about it as well, is that when you optimize for learning, the product turns out the best as well. And so it's kind of, optimizing for learning helps the product, and it, you know, having the shared mental models and those kind of things. So that's fantastic.
I think it's also important to remember that, I guess one thing I would say is learning today is productivity tomorrow. And so I think that there can often be an overemphasis on productivity in the short term. This idea that, you know, what we want is that, you know, at the end of this session, we produce the best possible thing as fast as possible. And if, well, what if you produce nothing usable at the end of this session, but everybody was fundamentally changed so that going forward, they were always more productive and worked together better because they had taken the time out. So you wouldn't see that yet, but you might see it in the future. So we would say, you know, even if it's not the case that what leads to learning now also leads to productivity now, maybe we should be thinking even in industry about that, you know, how we're orchestrating between short-term and long-term thinking.
Cool. Well, at least one other question I had was before, as we're getting near the end of the show, was for anybody out there who's doing university online coursework related to coding or maybe other types of things, what are the biggest benefits of doing it in this style from your research and your experience and maybe from the students' feedback, et cetera? And maybe what are some of the maybe cons, you know?
We definitely see the biggest advantage on the really hard content that students feel intimidated by. They feel much better prepared to launch into the individual big programming assignments after they've worked together. I think probably the students who are less prepared benefit the most from that engagement because they feel like, okay, now I think I can confidently move forward into this activity that I need to do. And we see that in the feedback. We do see that in the feedback. And it seems to me that that could even possibly figure into an industry context where there might be people who just are not very confident in themselves, or perhaps they are just learning a new software skill. And now you need them to be able to function in this team or to contribute towards a project. And, you know, they had to teach themselves stuff and, you know, they might have been able to do that, but they might just need to feel a little bit affirmed in that, you know, and have a chance to kind of bounce ideas off somebody else, maybe ask a few clarifying questions, and working together in this mob in this context where the goal is about learning might create those, that, you know, added sense of confidence, but maybe even also feeling like, okay, now I know who I would ask if I got stuck and I'm sitting in my office, you know, so maybe it builds up the social capital that you need in a company as well.
Chris, did you have anything else?
I just found this really interesting. And I think that I'm really interested to see what you do in the future. And I think that this idea of, you know, we always think of continuous learning and there are definitely organizations that either consider themselves in industry as learning organizations or not. I think the ones that consider themselves learning organizations that say that acknowledge the idea that people are constantly creating new technologies and we need to constantly be learning those technologies to be productive with them before the next new thing comes along. And so, you know, I think that this notion of just continuous skill building, even in an academic setting and in an industry setting, there's something to this idea that we can prepare people and maybe there is something along the lines of self-doubt that's being alleviated because people can actually voice their ideas together. So I just really like this notion of you know, that collective confidence being built up over time. So yeah, I really appreciate it. And this is a really cool idea. So I think if we wanted to call the show here, I think that that's a good thing. So anybody out there who is maybe needs a facilitator but doesn't have one, maybe check out the AI agent to facilitate your next mob. If anybody is interested in an academic experience with mobbing in general, then check out some of this research. Carolyn, do you have anything that you want to plug or mention alongside those things?
Well, I think an interesting idea that we're exploring is the bridging between formal instruction and practice in industry. And we want to see, you know, a more continuous flow between those two worlds. And we really see this software infrastructure for supporting mob programming in the classroom as a preparation for future support for learning in the workplace. And so we'd love to partner with people like you guys or anyone out there in the audience who's interested in this idea. So feel free to reach out to us for additional conversations along these lines.
Yes, absolutely. And as industry, as an industry practitioner who is heavily involved with different organizations, academic organizations, I'd say that one of the best things that a company can do is get involved at that level, and especially in those transitions, and it makes things a lot easier for things like hiring and expenses around that. And it also allows the students to learn what they're going to use in the industry, and vice versa. Those ideas, those findings on in the academic side, transition into the work environment much more easily as well. So yeah, I love it.
Yeah, and this is we want to thank and really appreciative of the work you and several others are doing in bringing kind of the academic side to mobbing, and it's phenomenal, all the papers being published, and we love gathering and seeing them being done, and so we thank you for that. And with that, please like and subscribe, and hit the notification bell to get more episodes. Yeah, we love seeing your feedback and more on YouTube, Twitter, and everything else. And until next time, mob well, have a good one.
Bye, everybody.